Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with my co-hosts, Max Linsky from Longform, Evan Ratliff from The Atavist. Good morning, fellas.
Great morning.
Excellent morning.
The best. I'm feeling good. I understand that you were feeling good while you were doing this interview, Max.
I was feeling good when I was doing this interview. I talked to Cord Jefferson, who is the West Coast editor for Gawker, and I really want to talk to him because he writes these feel-good sort of personal essays. The guy kind of like, he's a very sincere writer, and he's writing for Gawker. I don't know. I'm interested in what he's doing, so I made him come in and talk to me about it.
Some great satire, too.
He just did that thing where he was talking about how like the white community needs to step in with their rambunctious white youth.
Hilarious. If you have something hilarious to say to the people in your life, check out Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. They are our sponsor. They make a powerful but simple way that you can send an email newsletter. We thank them for their sponsorship, and we have another sponsor.
We do, Hulu Plus. Hulu Plus allows you to stream thousands of TV shows and movies straight to your phone or tablet or TV or anywhere else you would want to watch those things. You can sign up now, get a free trial, huluplus.com/longform.
And here's Max in conversation with Cord Jefferson.
Hey, Cord Jefferson.
Hello, Max.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
Thanks for coming to Dumbo and doing the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so there are a whole slew of things I want to talk to you about.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some things that I plan on talking about.
Okay.
A thing that I want to talk to you about is... you're sort of a little askew from like the people that we normally talk to, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
You're not writing giant features for giant magazines.
Yeah.
You mostly write for the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about that a little bit. You've also written these two essays, which really just like punched me in the stomach, mm-hmm. and I wanted to talk to you about them.
Okay.
So I asked you to come on because I just want to ask you about them.
Yeah.
And they both really got me in, like, I was thinking about it today. I was trying to, like, figure out why they, like, got me so much. I think they really, like, they both got me in, like, my, like, sensitive bro underbelly. They were just, like, hit me right there in my tenderest, most sensitive bro underbelly. So I want to talk to you about those. And then the other thing I want to talk to you about, we have people who come on a lot who have reached these kind of heights of, specifically long form journalism, but magazine stuff and just American journalism in general.
Mm-hmm.
And a pretty consistent like critique of the conversations we're having, or at least something that people really want to talk about, is money, and particularly like money early in people's career. And basically, mm-hmm. basically what people want to hear is like, I got help.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah,
because
of course.
We have a lot of folks who are listening who are like younger journalists and, trying to figure out like how the hell you get by in this stuff. And
yeah.
I think you've written pretty eloquently about that too. So I'm hoping we can talk about that. But here's where I want to start, right?
Okay.
So you are right now the West Coast editor for Gawker. That's your title.
Yep.
And on the site, you put up a couple of posts every day,
mm-hmm.
short stuff,
mm-hmm.
pretty like classic blogging.
Yeah.
Like the blogging that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've also written these essays, which I love so much. And you just did this thing where that was satire.
Yeah.
Which is like pretty straight comedy. And then you
the white rage piece.
The white rage piece.
Yeah.
And then took that to MSNBC and did it with Chris Hayes, which is like straight up like performance art.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So how do you think of yourself? I mean, how do you define yourself in this world? Are you a journalist? Are you a writer? Are you like a memoirist? Are you an entertainer?
When people ask me what I do, I just tend to say that I'm a writer. And that is, that's what I set out to do. You know, I put writer on my taxes, and that there's a lot of joy in that for me. There's a lot of joy in kind of, I just sit down and stare at a blank page and write stuff. And whether that be satire like that white rage piece, or whether it be a personal essay, or whether it be straightforward blogging stuff, it's kind of strange. I never sat down to be a journalist. I never sat down to be a novelist. I never sat down to be a comedy writer. I just wanted to do this thing. I just wanted to be a writer, which is this all-encompassing thing to me. And the fact that I haven't been forced to pick one path or choose one genre of writing thus far in my career is something that I'm actually pretty happy about. And I think in a way, I might be a little bit disappointed if I was kind of latched to one genre of writing or one style of writing. I think that it's kind of fun to be able to go in and say, like, I want to write a kind of a long form reported journalistic piece today, or I want to go in and write a personal essay today. And the great thing about Gawker is that you can do that. There's room to do that. There's a lot of places that don't give you that kind of freedom. And that's one of the beautiful things about being there, is that just as long as it's interesting, as long as it's funny, as long as it's good, they're open to the idea.
Do you, like, how does the inspiration for that stuff come? So, like, let's take the White Rage piece as an example. Like, was that an idea? Maybe you can just, like, summarize it quickly for people who maybe didn't read it. Although, if anyone was on the internet and didn't see that story, it'd be kind of amazing.
There was these surf riots in the wake of this surf competition in Huntington Beach, and a bunch of teenagers, many of whom were white, destroyed Huntington Beach and sort of were getting in fights in the streets and overturning porta potties and smashing stuff and looting.
You just like slipped into your like newscaster voice.
And it was just and I just made fun of it and I used it to make fun of. It was timely because the week before, you had Bill O'Reilly in the wake of the Trayvon Martin verdict saying that, you know, young black people are bringing this upon themselves because there's this thug culture that exists in the black community, and that's why the black community can't pull itself up by its bootstraps. Just kind of like classic conservative nonsense. And then you had Don Lemon, who was actually exacerbated everything by going on his CNN show and saying, you know, Bill O'Reilly has a point, and, you know, it's the black kids are sagging their pants and they're littering, and I mean, it's just nonsense. Everybody knows it. I mean, not everybody, obviously, but it's ridiculous. And so, coming off of that and sort of thinking about how to talk about those issues, but without doing the same kind of just like angry blogging that so many people end up doing.
Yeah.
The riots came along, and I found it was a perfect opportunity to kind of mock the Bill O'Reillys and the Don Lemons of the world in an interesting way. And it's, I mean, obviously satire, and even satire of that stripe is not anything new. I didn't invent the wheel, but it was fun to write and I mean, it obviously did very well, and I'm happy about that. And that came to light just because we were joking around in Campfire. It was just a chat. I just put the link for the riot story into Campfire, and just made, you know, like a stupid like joke.
Campfire, like, is like the internal Gawker.
Yeah, it's like the internal Gawker like chat system.
Yeah,
I just threw it in. And it was like, these dangerous white teenagers are out of control, you know. And Tom Skoka, the managing editor of Gawker, was like, you should expand on that, do that. And so it was, you know, it was a kernel of an idea, and then he just said, write that. And so I wrote it, and it took like 45 minutes, and then it was up. And it,
really, you just wrote it in 45 minutes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that's, and then like, all right, we'll walk us through that, right? So you like put that thing up, mm-hmm. and then pretty quickly it's like everywhere.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about, there's something maddening about, I'll admit that writing in this day and age, there's something maddening about the idea that you know, even as recently as like 10, 15 years ago, plenty of writers, you know, got weeks and weeks to work on pieces, and they're working at a magazine, and they get to work for months and months on stuff. And that, to me, I really envy that sometimes, this idea of, because the clarity of thought that you get when you can actually sit down and sleep on something and come back to something over a period of weeks and months and even years sometimes, the clarity of thought that you can get with that really does improve a piece from time to time. And I think that I'm jealous of the writers in that era who got the time to do that kind of thing.
Do you feel like you don't have the option of doing that? Like, are there not pieces that get to like percolate in your mind for a while?
There are absolutely pieces that get to do that, even at Gawker. But the thing is that there's also the pieces that you kind of have to write, because it's a 24-hour news cycle, and you publish everything throughout the day, and you sometimes just need to write something for that day. And so there are, I think that any person who writes consistently for the internet would be lying if they said that they didn't publish something that maybe even 2 days later they didn't necessarily agree with, or at least they didn't agree with, you know, a significant portion of it because they had got time to think about it. And that's a little frustrating. But the beauty is that it also that kind of speed allows for something like that Riots piece, because right. It was, you know, it was a quick idea. It was, you know, it was funny to us. We thought it would have an impact, and so we were able to bang it out in the course of an hour and put it up, and it did really well, and it took off. And I'm not that happens from time to time, and so it's a blessing and a curse sometimes, the speed of the internet.
Do you think like you kind of have to have like the mentality of an athlete with that stuff? Like you got to just like a shooter just keeps shooting until they hit one. You know, like you can't. You got to just put it out of your mind.
Yeah.
Even if you like look back at something on the site from a couple of days ago and you're like, I don't know about that one.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to be like, move on, like moving forward.
Yeah. And that's something that has taken me a long time to learn. And that was something that I used to be really gun shy about what I published, and used to be really nerve wracking. And especially when you start at Gawker, which has such a huge audience, when you start at Gawker, pretty much everybody that I've seen who starts, gets gun shy and gets really nervous because you're kind of terrified at how quickly people are going to see everything that you do. And
how does that change? Like, do you have to just like put something stupid up once and get like dinged everywhere and realize like you're still like breathing afterwards?
Yeah, it's a day. I mean, it's a daily struggle with yourself. And there are some days where I leave the office, or I mean, you generally work from home, so where I get up from my desk.
Some days where I put pants on.
Yeah, exactly. Some days when I leave my bed, where I feel disappointed and feel like I haven't really done a lot of that, done a lot of stuff that I really liked that day. But there are also days when I'll put something up that I really love and that I think is really good, and that I think have, you know, helped the dialogue and helped progress a conversation or added some value to the world in a certain way, and those days balance out the days where I'm not too pleased. And I think that there's ups and downs with everybody. Not everything's going to be a home run, and you just kind of have to sort of make peace with that and move forward.
I just want to talk about this for 1 second. I mean, do you think that like those muscles are like in relationship to each other? Like, do you think if you're working that 24-hour news cycle and you're putting up a couple posts a day and you're like linking off with a joke and doing that over and over again, and mm-hmm. you're building up, like that's, you start seeing the world that way a little bit.
Yeah.
And that becomes like a way that you write. That's like a muscle that gets in shape. Do you think that that muscle gets in shape at the detriment of sort of your longer term thinking, or are they kind of unrelated and you're just Cord Jefferson writer? I apply my writerly brain to whatever I want.
That is a good question, and it is, but it's something that I feel like I've been able to avoid because I write so many different things. You know, I'll write like a 3,500 word piece or 5,000 word piece, and then I'll also write a snarky, you know, kind of cutting joke in one line, linking out to some other place. And I think that I don't think that one is necessarily better than the other. It really makes me sad to hear anyone sort of disparage kind of the speed and the immediacy and the economy of words that the internet uses sometimes. I think there are some people who are absolutely brilliant in 140 characters, you know, and I think that there are people whose abilities on the internet are kind of amazing to me, and I think that there's some things that there's tweets that people write that to me can be as interesting or as funny as a 2,000 word essay that somebody writes, and I don't think that doing one too often should sort of fatigue your other muscles to do the other. I think that maybe there's, I guess the way that the internet might influence your thinking is there is kind of a general tone to the internet, and there is kind of a tone to the internet that is, because I'm it's funny that you said sensitive bro. I consider myself kind of a sincere person sometimes. Too
that was
sincere.
That was my insincere way of saying that. Your sincerity
yeah.
gets me.
Yeah. I think that I tend to be a pretty sincere human being, and I think that there is every now and again, the way that I use the internet and the way that the internet carries itself and the way the internet has dialogues is often very insincere and is a little bit, you know, tongue in cheek all the time. That concerns me. I don't ever want to lose my sincerity. I don't ever want to lose my ability to feel emotional about things that I write about. I don't ever want to like everything that I write, I have a distance from, you know. And I think that can be a danger sometimes of writing too much for the internet, is that you have this kind of elitist distance from everything, and that, you know, nothing really matters, you know.
Hey, this is that moment in the show where I pause things and tell you about our sponsor. We've got a sponsor. Amazing. It's Hulu Plus. Even more amazing. You've probably tried Hulu.com. You know about it. All kinds of new TV shows, all kinds of great movies. Hulu Plus allows you to take all that stuff and stream it to your phone, your tablet, your TV. That's what I do using Roku. It streams in HD. It's great. There are actual shows you would want to watch. Saturday Night Live is on there. The Daily Show is on there. Modern Family, I don't know, everything else that just won an Emmy. They've also got original stuff now. They've got a new show called The Awesomes that stars Saturday Night Live Seth Meyers, another show called Moon Boy, which stars Chris O'Dowd from Bridesmaids. Anyway, there's all kinds of great stuff on there. You can watch as much of it as you want using Hulu Plus for just $8 a month. And right now, if you go to huluplus.com/longform, that's huluplus.com/longform, you can get an extended free trial, try it out, see if you like it. If you're going to do that, though, really do use that URL. It's a way of supporting the show, which we appreciate. All right, let's get back to court. I apologize for, like, taking a snarky response to that very sincere comment, but I think there's something kind of most people maybe would not assume that someone who works at Gawker is a fierce defender of their own sincerity.
Yeah.
That's not the, like, standard sort of Gawker pitch. Is it tricky to do that there, or is it not? Like, I guess how do you, writing for a place that is maybe even sort of like too well known for that side?
Yeah.
How do you sort of keep that in check? How do you like keep sort of doing what you want to do? How do you stay sincere?
I mean, look, I don't think that some of the assumptions people have about Gawker are all untrue. I'm not gonna say that everything that people say about Gawker is necessarily inaccurate. I will say that a lot of it I think is inaccurate, and I will say that I think that if people actually look on Gawker and actually read it consistently, they'll see that it's not like a snark factor. I remember reading when I first started, somebody tweeted like, "Oh, classic example of the Gawker snark factory. Well, like this is what they do so well." And I remember thinking that, like, if you actually believe that Gawker is just purely a snark factory, then you don't read Gawker. You read articles about Gawker from 2008. You know what I mean? You don't even read current articles about Gawker. You read 6 year old articles about Gawker,
right.
And this is where you're
New
drawing
York magazine.
Yeah, this is where you're drawing conclusions from. Again, I don't think that it's inaccurate to say that people on Gawker can be mean sometimes, and that that in the past there's been stuff on Gawker that's been mean spirited. I'm not going to say that. But at the same time, I think that I would like to think that every time that I've written on Gawker hasn't been malicious. To people who think that what we do is mean, and to people who think that that it's just kind of people are in there and like banging out posts and like cackling and really excited to see tears and to see people's lives ruined, that's not the case. The staff of Gawker is full of smart, thoughtful, talented people. I really do believe that. I feel like people envision us like our feet on the desks and like high-fiving one another as we like tear a person's life apart, and that's
jars of tears.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not the case, but I do think that Gawker is committed to telling truths, and I think that oftentimes truths, unvarnished truths, can be painful for people to read and can be painful for people's friends and family to read. And I think that there is I'm paraphrasing Hamilton Nolan, an interview that he did, I want to say with Poynter or Romanesco. And Hamilton said that essentially that Gawker's commitment is to the truth. And that's the one commitment that people have. And I think that sometimes that irritates people, because I think that the way that Gawker writers view the truth sometimes is probably the differently than the way that people Gawker writes about view the truth.
All right. I want to talk about the New York essay. You wrote this essay about leaving New York and it was on Gawker.
Yeah.
But you also wrote this essay about your friend's dad,
mm-hmm.
who was this kind of like wonderful guy, this wonderful adventurous guy,
mm-hmm.
Who had taken his own life,
mm-hmm.
While you were on an adventure with his son, who's one of your best friends.
Yeah.
And it's really like, it's a wonderful thing. If you have not read it, go read it. It is ultimately about like why you should jump off like literal cliffs yeah. in addition to metaphorical ones. And like, again, you know, It like got me. I was like, I shouldn't go jump off a cliff. I would like to jump off a cliff. I also don't really like heights. I played football and hated it. Like, yeah. It was like, yeah, all right. I'm hang gliding. Okay. But you published that on The Awl.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I guess, like, here's what I'm saying, Greg. Like, I really liked that essay. It was different than most of the stuff I read on the internet. It was really sincere.
Yeah.
It was personal, like, you were kind of like vulnerable and out there and it was funny and stuff. But unlike a lot of the stuff on the internet, like it made me feel like good afterwards.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like optimistic and yeah. hopeful, which is like
chicken soup for the soul.
You know, it's like 0.01% of the internet there. You know, like most days I sit and look at the internet and like I leave and I'm like, oh God, and, like, you know, like I don't feel great.
Yeah.
First of all, like why was that on The Awl and not on Gawker?
That was on The Awl because The Awl, that was for an Awl series at the end of last year about the best advice that you got all year. And when Leo had committed suicide, I kind of stepped back from it for a bit, and it took me a while. But I kind of knew that I wanted to write about it one day, and I didn't know what I wanted to write about him, but I just felt that... I felt that he was a man that I wanted to write about. And I didn't know how to do that. And I talked to my friend Chris, and I first asked him and asked his family if they would feel comfortable with me ever writing about this. And they all gave me their blessing. And so I thought about it for a little bit more. And then The Awl, like serendipitously, came and said, hey, we're doing this end of the year series. Would you want to contribute something to it? And I thought that would be a perfect time to write about this. So it wasn't like I took that piece to Gawker and they said, no, we're not going to do this. Gawker is like obviously very, very timely and news driven, but Gawker, have you seen Gawker does like an essay series on Saturdays.
Yeah, on Saturdays.
Yeah.
It's great.
Run by Kesey Lehman. It's it's not a place where that is necessarily anti any kind of literary essays or things
right.
that. So that started with that New York piece, leaving New York piece.
To talk a little bit more about that New York essay, what was the reaction to it? I know that at least one reaction was me emailing you from the San Francisco airport where I was like, I just spent like a week on the West Coast and it was like gorgeous. I'd been in like Seattle and it was like that perfect Seattle weather.
Yeah.
And everyone was in like the best mood.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I doing? Like, why do I live in this place?
Good.
Live in a box, spend $1 million. Like, what am I doing? It's so beautiful here. Everyone's so happy.
Good. That was.
So you really, it was like, there was like a sunset at SFO, you know, and I was just like.
One of those perfect California days.
Yes. I should just like mm-hmm. throw this ticket away and walk out that front door.
You can still do it. LA is big. It's
yeah, I'm probably not gonna do that. New York is amazing. Are you crazy? The best city on the world. But what was the reaction to that piece, man? What was
the reaction was it's a comment section is a comment section, and the reaction in the comment section was a lot of New Yorkers screaming at me that I just didn't get it. You just didn't get it. You're a quitter. New York doesn't want you here anyway. You're like, you whiny hipster. So there was a lot of that in the comments. But then behind the scenes, I got a ton of emails about that and even a couple phone calls, I think, from people who said that it was really important to them and really helped them in a certain way. And I think that when people leave New York, they feel like losers and they feel like they couldn't cut it. And I think that when that's very much the case for when people leave any big city, you know, when people leave LA, when people leave San Francisco, I think they feel like it can be a very difficult thing for people. And so some of the most beautiful emails that I got were from people who left New York or from people who were considering leaving New York and were saying who said like this really helps me feel better about my decision, because there's a lot of people who really tie their ego and their sense of self-worth to the city that they live in. That's something that really opened my eyes to that phenomenon. I kind of touched on that in the piece, but I didn't really realize the depth of that for many people. And I got a lot of emails from people who said, you know, I left New York, I'm living back home with my parents, because it was, you know, that was, you know, mid financial crisis when a lot of people are moving home and are moving away from these big cities. I live at home with my parents, or, you know, I moved to a different place because there just wasn't any work in New York. Who really appreciated it, who had been wanting to read something, not like there's so many pieces about how New York is so great and why New York City is the best place in the world, you know, like who wants to read that again, you know? And I think that New Yorkers want to read that again, you know. New Yorkers want to live
in a box affirmation. Yeah,
exactly. You need to delude yourself in a certain way that it's all worth it. But that piece and that kind of bout of sincerity did really well, and I think that people were happy to read it, and it did well traffic wise, and that piece is probably the one that I still get the most emails about. I'll still, like, at least once a month get an email from somebody that's like, I just moved to LA from New York, or I just moved away from New York.
Can we hang out?
Yeah. It was like, so that was really important to me, and I'm really happy that you said it.
I like that phrase, bout of sincerity. How important is, like, traffic as a metric for what you're doing? Like, when you write that Chris Hayes thing, or when you post that essay,
mm-hmm.
are you like, this is going to kill? And does that mean, you know, that number next to the post is going to be huge?
I think anybody who writes to the internet would be lying if they say they don't consider traffic. And that is,
I guess I'm asking, how important is that compared to, like, something that, putting out something that, like, you won't feel that way 2 days later. You won't feel kind mm-hmm. of sheepish about 2 days later.
Traffic is important to me. I mean, let's get real. Traffic is integral to what I do. The reason that I have my job is to try and get as much traffic as possible for an internet website. Like, at its core, I'm fully willing to put that on the table and say that is at its core what we do. We exist and we are successful because we get a lot of eyeballs on our website. As far as whether or not I consider, like, the popularity of it on the internet as being important when I write something, I would say that is not something that sort of comes into my mind a lot when I sit down to write a thing that's actually really important to me, you know.
How has it been navigating the media world from LA? Good.
Oh yeah. I prefer it. I actually prefer it. There is a I think there's probably certainly career opportunities that I've missed out on, even for just, like, freelance pieces, by not having a network in New York City. And that's something that I've been willing to part with, I guess, in a certain way.
You have a decent network in New York City. Your phone is ringing like 15 times.
Yeah. I'm not struggling for, like, New York City friends. And I'm not opposed to living in New York again one day if my job calls for it. I would probably, if it were the right opportunity, I'd move back to New York, you know. And I told them at Gawker that when they first hired me, that, you know, if you ever need me in New York, if you really absolutely need me, I would probably move to New York, but I just don't want to. And luckily they've been allowing me to work remotely. But there's a certain kind of strange clannishness about the New York media scene, and that is a bit off-putting to me. My friends in Los Angeles, certainly some of them are writers, but my friends in Los Angeles are musicians and architects and film producers and you know, teachers, art therapists. You know, these are the people that I spend my time with a lot of the time. And I don't spend my time with a lot of writers talking about media gossip. And I'm not saying that there's not a time and place for all that, and I certainly love to hear as much media gossip as the next guy. I work at a website that started out as a media gossip blog, but it's kind of nice to just be out of that scene for a little bit, because I think that it is, I mean, this is such a competitive industry, and this is such a, it's so competitive what we do, and it's so cutthroat in many ways, and it's difficult. It's hard. being a writer is a hard job, and being a publisher and being an editor, it's a hard job. And I think that if I were surrounded by that all the time, I don't think that there's any way that I wouldn't be thinking about comparing myself to other people, and comparing my career to other people's careers, and sort of getting into this habit.
You're legitimately not doing that?
I'm not saying that I'm. Oh no, let's get real. Everybody goes on like their jealous jags every now and again, but I think that I do it far less than I would if I were like
right.
at a New York media party, and like, okay, it's like you got to go sit on a panel, and you're hanging out with like these people from this magazine or these people from this website, and you're looking at that writer and wondering why they got that story and you didn't get that story. And I think that when you're literally surrounded by it, then that inclination becomes much easier. And for me, being separate from it, kind of literally and figuratively, in a certain way, I think is better for my psyche overall.
Well, there's another part of what you're talking about. I mean, like, you're really thoughtful about this stuff, and that was part of why I wanted to talk to you for this, because we get this like consistent line of people asking us to sort of get more real about the like economics of being a writer.
Mm-hmm.
In 2013,
yeah,
and in I guess it was in March, maybe, I don't know, that whole Nate Thayer thing happened, right?
Yeah,
the guy the Atlantic, and yeah. You know, some editor asked him to give them a story for free, and he wrote about not writing for free, and it prompted that whole conversation, and
yeah.
A bunch of people like actually said kind of what they'd earned, but only sort of,
yeah,
and like it was like this big flare up in that online media world.
Mm-hmm.
And then it died.
Yeah.
And I don't want to talk about it again. but for a brief moment, people were talking about it. And I thought you wrote something really thoughtful about it, which was basically like, instead of just focusing on the sort of like morality of paying or not paying for the people who are writing,
mm-hmm.
let's think about who this explicitly outlaws from this profession.
Yeah.
And what is that doing to the profession?
Yeah.
So maybe... could you talk a little bit about your experience starting out in New York and starting out as a freelancer and how money was involved? So, yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean, that, so that piece basically just said that these kinds of policies by creating an industry that doesn't pay writers has created an industry that is dominated by writers who come from wealth. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that you're as rich as Croesus, like wealth, but it can be just like if your parents, you know, have middle class people who can afford to like float you some rent money every now and again. So my story is very much a typical story in that regard, because I initially, to be very honest, when I moved to New York, I moved with my girlfriend at the time, who got a job at Juilliard. And I was kind of miserable in my old job in Los Angeles, and I had started writing freelance stuff, and it was started. I was doing freelance music journalism for a while. I thought I wanted to be a music journalist, and so I'd done like a couple small reviews for Filter magazine in Los Angeles, and I think that I'd interviewed a musician and written that piece, and so. You know, for me, I was like, I'm killing it. Like, I gotta go to New York now. It's where the real writers are. I gotta be in New York. And so I moved here with $5,000 that, so my parents didn't give me $5,000, but my parents had given me a car when I was in Los Angeles. And I sold my car. And they were like, you can keep the money, like this, that will be your money. And so I sold the car for, I can't remember, it's like maybe $6,000. And
was your New York dowry.
Yeah. That was like how I got on my feet in New York, you know? Yeah. And then, I ended up getting an internship at Nerve magazine, which is like kind of a shell of itself at this point. But back then it was doing really well. And it was based in Soho, and they were starting up a new blog that was going to be called Babbel, that was going to be a parenting blog, and I got an editorial internship there that paid a stipend of $400 a month. And so that was like...
It's pretty good for someone with no parenting experience.
Yeah, exactly. But Nerve was like, do you remember Nerve?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so that basically paid like half my rent. And I didn't have to pay for car insurance or gas or anything at that point. So that kind of largesse for my parents really helped me get on my feet and establish myself a little bit. That was about 6 years ago. So for the past 6 years, I've been getting paid to write. And I wouldn't have been able to move to New York, at least. To me, I thank them so much for that. But I also don't ever want to lose sight of the fact that there are so many people kept out of this profession and kept out of doing, even if it's not writing. There's so many people who are kept out of acting and being a musician. And there's so many people who kept out of following any dream, be it creative or not, but following so many other dreams because they can't afford it.
What do you think the impact is on this particular profession?
I think that is why it is not shocking to look at mastheads of big publications and see if you were to ask people, and it's like, where'd you graduate college? Yale, Harvard, Princeton. Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Penn. You know, and Gawker is part of that. You know, there's a lot of prestigious Ivy League universities underneath the Gawker Media umbrella. And I think I'm not saying that there aren't really wonderful writers who have graduated from Harvard and Yale. I think that there's a lot of people who are really talented and really smart who went to those places and who are not kind of clustered into their like weird little like Harvard clubs and like talking about squash all the time. But I do think that there's not a diversity of, not just racial diversity, but there's not a diversity of thought that I think there should be in media today. There's not a good breadth of experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the really like important point that you were making in that piece, which I just wanted to bring up again because it's been a while. It's just like, it's not just the injustice for the people who are doing the work and not getting paid, which is a shitty thing.
Yeah.
It's the fact that there are whole scores of people who cannot take that financial proposition. Not that it's a shitty financial proposition, but they're willing to take it.
Yeah.
But that they can't take it.
Yeah. And that to me is like the, I think that people, I love my job and it brings me, I just got goosebumps a little bit because this is so true and it makes me so sad. I love what I do every day, and it's allowed me such amazing experiences. It's allowed me to meet some of my best friends and people that I really appreciate and respect. But like, I don't ever want to lose sight of the fact that it is such a luxury to do what you want to do every day, to wake up and enjoy what you do, and wake up and enjoy your job, and wake up and feel like your what you are doing and what you are contributing sort of means something. And I don't ever want to lose sight of that. And that is something that so many people just can't afford to do. So many people can't afford to wake up and do what they want to do. They can't afford to dedicate their youth to pursuing something that may never pay off financially in the end. Then they have to just wake up and get their nose to the grindstone and do a job they hate forever, you know? And I think that some people in our industry can forget about that and can forget that, you know, and I think that there's talk on the internet sometimes that, like, you know, cream rises to the top and you know, if you're a great writer, you'll get exposure and people will find you, and it's a meritocracy.
Yeah, I mean that you know, that philosophy is like pretty strong in the Silicon Valley thing.
Yeah,
with like that sort of libertarian bent where it's like we are the best and the brightest.
Yeah, and I think that people trick themselves that's the reality, and it's like you may be a great writer, but I can guarantee you thousands, if not millions, of great artists in this world have lived and died without ever creating something because they couldn't afford to, you know? I believe that.
I don't expect you to, like, have the, like, answer to the world's problems.
Yeah.
But this is a point that, like, you continue to sort of bring up and raise.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about how it can be improved? Like, if you were running a news organization, do you have an idea of how you try and do it differently?
Oh, my God. I guess one thing that the only thing that I can think of is what people's salaries are at the top. I would be interested to see at failing media enterprises and at media enterprises that can't afford to pay, that quote unquote can't afford to pay writers. I'd be interested to see how much their executives are being paid, and whether that be an executive editor, whether that be an executive salesperson. If you were to open those books and you saw that, you know, these executive editors and like I said, executive salespeople are making, you know, $50,000 a year, and they're working 80-hour weeks, and they really can't afford to pay anybody. It's like, well, you know, that's great, and I'm happy for you. But I would be kind of surprised if that were the case at a lot of these places. I would be kind of surprised if any place that says, you know, we absolutely can't afford to pay you, if that's actually true, that you absolutely can't afford to pay somebody. I just always feel like it's how you divide the pie, and it's like if it and
yeah, I think it's also about where you place value. So, like, another response I've heard in this conversation is like, it's a market thing, right? So if you can get labor or content for free,
yeah,
if that's where, like, the market is, yeah, then you shouldn't pay if it's free, right?
Yeah.
If you can get it for free, you shouldn't pay.
Yeah.
And I think that in, you know, that's, there is some logic there in the world we live in. So it feels to me like you have to place value in not just quality, but in diversity to really do what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, and it has to be a value of the operation.
Yeah. And there's, I would, and to this conversation, I always say also that this isn't, you know, this isn't a new problem. Well, writers. I remember I looked at did you see that Walt Whitman letter that somebody tweeted out today? It was a letter that Walt Whitman had written to The Atlantic, and he said, you know, I'm submitting two poems for publication, and if you print them, I would like $8 a piece. And somebody looked at what that $8 a piece would have been in 2013 money, and it was just like a couple hundred bucks for Walt Whitman, you know, to write for The Atlantic. So it's not like
but put that on your personal blog and yeah, then we'll link to
exactly.
it.
Exactly. No, tweet the link out. No, there is, so I don't think that there wasn't necessarily a time when a lot of writers were, you know, rolling in the dough. I think that there are some great success stories in history that people see, but I also think that people working for less than probably what their value is a problem that's been going on for a long time, and I don't, maybe I should have stuck with the answer that I don't know if I have the answer. I'd like to believe that there is an answer, but I also don't want to. Part of the problem that I have with saying, like, if people wouldn't do it, then it would fix the problem, is that, like, to me it sounds very victim blamey, because the fact of the matter is that if you want to work in this industry right now, you have to write for free. You have to be willing to do that. And I did that. That's the reality of the situation. And so to me, saying that, like, if a bunch of writers got together and decided we won't do this anymore, you know, I've heard a lot of, you know, you see a lot of writers who write those kinds of emails who say, like, I'm not going to work for free. Screw you. This is, you know, you got to value me. The reality is that they're going to say, okay, fine, like, we're going to go and somebody else is going to write this for us for free. And like I said, I feel like some people talk about people who write for free as like scabs, you know, and that there's a strike and you're crossing the picket line, man, if you do that and you're screwing us all over. And I don't believe that, because, like I said, this is a this is a very hard industry that we're in, and being a writer is very, it's very hard. And you don't, I feel like having these, having loyalty to other writers above kind of doing work that you love and trying to build your career is not a good way to parse the situation.
We're probably not going to solve it today.
Well, maybe we can have a couple more of these beers.
Okay, we'll think about it. If you figure out the like perfect solution, then we'll come back and we'll unveil it to the world. I want to let you go, but I have one more question. So you started out in New York, came here with the $5,000 from selling your car.
Yeah,
made it happen. Started writing some pieces, got hired.
I went and worked at The Root.
Right.
So first I worked at the Center for American Progress at this place, and then I went to The Root and was at The Root for maybe like a year, and then I jumped to L.A.
Went to L.A. and worked at Good.
Mm-hmm.
I talked at length with Ann.
With Ann about Good,
About Good, about the end of Good, so we don't need to get all into that, I don't think. And now you're the West Coast editor for Gawker.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have not said your age this entire time. How old are you?
I'm 31.
31.
Yeah.
So you've done all these things, kind of have worked yourself around.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want to get to?
I want to broaden my abilities. There's still a lot of writing that I haven't done yet that I really want to do.
I asked you that question once before. I should tell you.
Which one?
Like, what do you want to do with the rest of your life?
Yeah.
Who do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And your answer was Graydon Carter.
Yeah, I mean, that's still true. Graydon Carter was my answer and still is my answer because Graydon Carter does a bunch of weird stuff now. You know, he started Spy Magazine, which was obviously like a very important moment in sort of how magazines operated. And they were doing kind of things that were ahead of their time and really interesting and incisive and funny. But then he went from that and ended up working at Vanity Fair, which is obviously like a big traditional legacy media brand. But then he went from that, and like Graydon Carter's in movies now, and he's acting, and he like owns a restaurant, and he owns a bar, and he went and sort of used his skill set as a writer and an editor and somebody in media to do a bunch of other things outside of that, and that's what I mean. He used what he knew how to do to end up doing 10 things that he didn't know how to do, and that he just kind of developed into and grew into. And I think that there's something really beautiful and special about evolving constantly. That's a vision that I would like to follow along. I don't know if I'm going to be in movies one day, but I guess I wouldn't ever like to say that I'd be opposed to it.
Hey, Corey, thanks a lot, man.
Thank
you. I appreciate
you
coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lammer. Our wonderful editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our sponsors this week, Hulu Plus and Tiny Letter. Thanks very much to them. And thanks to our intern, Gavin Jenkins. We'll be back next week.